Alvargas settled carefully in the stern, as if he wanted to keep some distance between the two of us. I asked if we were headed back to the harbor now.
Nope, said Joseph. Gotta pick up some lobsters first.
Oh, of course.
Pick up some lobsters and get them back to the harbor. You don't mind if we stop at the harbor first. You get the best price if you're in early.
Of course I don't mind. Just do your job and pretend I'm not here.
Don't know if I can do that.
Oh? Why not?
Joseph popped the crust of his sandwich into his mouth and stared straight ahead. Hate to have to tell you this, Miss Schuyler, but you smell like bait. Bait and lobster.
So do you.
He lifted his arm and sniffed his shirt. Blow me down. How about we go for a swim?
What, here? Now?
Why not? He reached for the throttle. Pops, you don't mind, do you?
Vargas shrugged and leaned back in his seat. He'd finished his sandwich, and beneath the shelter of his hat, he looked as if he might be falling asleep.
Come on, said Joseph, pulling off his oilskins, yanking off his boots. Last one in.
Last one in is what?
I guess you're going to find out, he said, and he climbed on the bow and dove like a dolphin into the water.
A moment later, he came up again, and I cupped my hands around my mouth. What about sharks?
You just punch them on the nose, Schuyler. Don't you know anything?
I glanced back over my shoulder at Vargas, who sat with his arms folded, watching me curiously, as if he was making a bet in his head about what I might do or not do, swim or not swim. What about my dress? I can't swim in a dress like this.
Excuses. Take it off, then. You've got a petticoat or something, right?
He was swimming in place, looking up at me, his wet hair plastered over his head. I saw the white of his t-shirt under the water, his churning legs. Turn around, I said.
Come on, I won't look.
Turn around. He turned. I reached back and found the buttons of my dress, and when I started to struggle, Vargas came up and helped me with his gnarled, thick fingers. The dress gave way and I kicked it off. Kicked off my sandals, too, and I leapt in my short petticoat into the water. It was colder than I thought, much colder than the swimming pool at Greyfriars. I came up gasping. The first thing I saw was the sun, and then Joseph's grinning face below it. I thought his hair was like a helmet, shining like that. I called across the water.
You looked! Ah, can you blame me?
He dove back in, like something had swallowed him, and I stared at the gentle chop of the water while my heart beat and beat. A moment later, he came up beside me, closer than I thought. His grin wasn't so wide now, more like a question, and I said, a little raspy,
"Race you back to the boat?" "But it's right there," he pointed.
"All right." I turned and swam away in steady strokes, like my father had taught me on the Delaware beaches before the war.
"Don't fight the water, Miranda," he used to tell me, as we trundled along past the breakers,
and even though I became a strong enough swimmer, I remained grateful for his calm, muscular body, or so it seemed to me at the time, age 7 or 8, keeping me company. Funny, I never thought of sharks then, and my father never mentioned them. It was my mother who liked to keep to the shallows, my mother who was afraid. When I had gone about 20 or 30 yards, I stopped and turned, and there was Joseph right beside me. "Ready?" I said. "Set? Go!" Of course, he leapt right ahead of me. I mean, I couldn't compete with those shoulders, those experienced arms. But I was glad he didn't give me any quarter. I didn't want any favors. I just stroked with all my might, strained every absolute muscle, wasting not a single speck of energy in trying to keep sight of Joseph's churning body. But I thought I was close. When my fingers touched the hull of the boat, I looked up, panting.
"I'll be damned," said Joseph, panting too. "You're pretty strong."
"I've been swimming laps in the pool all summer."
He snorted. "Pools are for kids."
"Maybe I'm still just a kid then."
"I wouldn't say that."
We were right up against the hull, half holding the ropes that hung from the side. The boat had turned a little in the current, so the sun struck our wet cheeks, our dripping ears. I couldn't see Mr. Vargas from where I was, floating next to that wall of white paint, and I guessed he couldn't see us. And maybe Joseph had the same thought. He glanced up briefly, and his face softened, and his smile disappeared.
"Miranda," he said. I didn't answer, just kind of kept myself afloat, holding the rope with one hand, waving my legs next to his, hanging myself on the quiet brown color of his eyes. I thought how long and dark his lashes were. His face moved, turning to an angle as he leaned forward and kissed me on the lips, salty and brief. "Oh," I said.
"Do you mind?"
I shook my head. Under the water, he touched my waist very lightly and drew me closer. My legs tangled with his as I kicked them back and forth.
"Hold still,"
he whispered, so I stopped churning and put my left hand on his shoulder to steady myself in the water. He kissed me again, just as gentle but much deeper, and the salty, silky perfume of his mouth stunned me. All I remembered of Clay was the taste of whiskey. This was more real. This was like the essence of Joseph, the way two animals might know each other. The water tossed against us. For an instant, my legs found the current and slipped between his, and our stomachs met, our chests met, our lips fell apart. We were both still panting, maybe because of that reckless swimming, and maybe because of each other. Joseph's hand tightened about my waist, but only to return us to a more demure alignment, to allow a little decorous water to flood back between my stomach and his stomach, between my white petticoat and his white shirt. I think I laughed, out of nervousness, out of shock, and so did he.
"I've been wanting to do that all summer," he said.
"Really?"
"Really. Really. Are you surprised?"
"Yes, I thought...
"Thought what?"
"Well, Isabel, obviously." His brows slanted together.
"Isabel? Isabel what?"
"You and Isabel."
"That?"
He was astonished.
"Oh boy, you thought that..."
The boat swung suddenly, catching us with a thump. Joseph pulled me free, but the enchantment was broken, and Vargas's anxious voice floated above us, calling our names.
"Right here, Pops," Joseph said. "Can you get the towels from the deckhouse?"
There was a noise of resignation from above. Joseph still held me by the waist, and my hand still rested on his shoulder. He turned his head back to me and kissed me again, swiftly.
"We'll climb in over the stern. It's easier."
He held my hand as we half swam, half rappelled to the back of the boat. He helped me up over the side, where Vargas, looking carefully away, gestured to the towels on the bench. Behind me, Joseph hoisted himself inside, and I wrapped myself in one towel and handed the other to him, though not before glimpsing his wet shirt, plastered against his chest, not before losing my breath all over again at the audacity of what I had done. What we both had done, Joseph and me. A real kiss, not a mistake. Not a drunken substitution of one woman's mouth for another's. A kiss of conscious intent. I couldn't look at him. I thought everything had changed. I would never be the same Miranda again, and he would never be the old Joseph. I sat on the bow in my towel, shivering, while the sun dried my hair and my petticoat, and Vargas piloted us toward the traps he and Joseph had laid yesterday. I licked my lips and tasted salt. And Joseph. 4. By the time we had collected the lobsters and returned to the harbor, it was past lunchtime, and the sun had crested the sky, and three fishing boats had already come in ahead of us.
"You had to swim," Vargas said to Joseph, shaking his head. "Ah, it was worth it, Pops. Best swim of my life."
Joseph winked at me, and I turned away, because I didn't know what to say in return. I had worked silently beside him, hoping that this shared labor would cure the exhilarating awkwardness that lay between us. Now it was even worse. The sight of Greyfriars had frozen my throat as we passed it on the way to the harbor. I thought of Isabel and what she would say, what she would do if she knew I had kissed Joseph. When I had confided to her about Clay a couple of days after the luau, she'd only laughed and said she hoped I enjoyed it, that you couldn't ask for a better boy for your first kiss than Clay Monk, and she was going to give him hell about it later. But I knew I couldn't tell Isabel that Joseph had kissed me, and I had kissed him back. That was no laughing matter. To kiss Joseph was unforgivable. Vargas brought the boat in, and Joseph jumped nimbly to the dock and wound the rope around the piling. I handed down the lobsters in their baskets, keeping clear of their snapping claws. There were 42 of what Joseph and his father called the little buggers, a good haul, and when the boat was clear, I jumped down too, of my own power, ignoring Joseph's outstretched hand.
"Hey," he said in a low voice, "what's the matter?"
"Nothing."
"Are you sore at me?"
"No, of course not." He put his hand on my elbow.
"Miranda, I'm sorry if I didn't mean to."
Vargas jumped down from the boat, practically between us, and went for the baskets.
"Joseph, you got work to do, all right? I got to sell these little buggers."
"Pops, Miranda, give me a minute here."
Vargas pointed to me.
"You come along with me, and I'll buy you an ice cream, okay?"
"Okay,"
I said meekly.
"Pops, wait a second. You clean that boat, son. That's all you got to do."
I had just enough courage to look over my shoulder as I walked down the dock with Mr. Vargas, carrying a couple of the wire baskets. But Joseph had already turned away to climb back inside the boat and put everything in order for the next day's work. Mr. Vargas's stumpy legs moved with remarkable speed. He didn't say a word until we reached the end of the dock and stepped onto the quay that ran along Hemlock Road, where he set down his lobster baskets and dug into his pocket.
"Here,"
he said to me, shoving a dollar bill in my hand.
"Go buy yourself some ice cream while I sell these little buggers."
"But I..." He took the baskets from my hand and picked up his own, and such was his strength and experience with these things, he trundled up Hemlock Street carrying all 42 little buggers in their wire baskets, snapping and crawling in wholly justified panic, poor things, without missing a step. The ice cream parlor was closed, had a little sign on the door handle that said back in 30 minutes, so I went into the general store instead. I thought I could use some ice cream. I thought I could eat a gallon of it after tending those lobster pots all morning, besides swimming, besides kissing Joseph. Sure enough, they had a soda fountain behind a long new Formica counter along one side of the store, trimmed in chrome, all out of place in that old-fashioned interior that smelled of must and spices. The old woman there offered me a choice between vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. I asked for a double, a scoop of strawberry and a scoop of chocolate, and as she bent over the freezer, I remembered with a shock that this was Joseph's grandmother. That she had lost a son to the war and another daughter in a terrible accident on the water the night that Joseph was born. That her husband was laid up after a heart attack and she ran the store by herself.
"That'll be 35 cents,
she said, handing me the cone. For an instant, I hesitated, because I realized this was Mr. Vargas's money. And there was something strange about taking money from Mr. Vargas to pay his mother-in-law for ice cream. On the other hand, I had damned well earned that dollar today, not by kissing his son, but by hauling those cages and getting those lobsters in their wire baskets. I took the dollar from the pocket of my sundress and handed it silently to her over the counter, and she pressed some buttons on the cash register and gave me 65 cents change.
"You're Mr. Fisher's new stepdaughter, aren't you?"
she said, as she gave me the money. "Yes," I said.
"How do you like it up at Greyfriars?"
It's beautiful, I guess." She nodded.
"Was that you I saw, coming in with the Vargases just now?"
"Yes, I went out lobstering with them today. Isabel, Miss Fisher's on the mainland with her mother, and I thought I had nothing else to do, so I..."
"Just watch yourself, sweetie," she said. "A lot can happen to a nice girl like you, if she's not careful."
I slid the 65 cents into my pocket and took a paper napkin for my ice cream. "Of course," I said. Mrs. Madeira reached out a long, bumpy hand and took my wrist.
"I mean it. You watch yourself. Don't mix yourself up with any of it."
"Any of what?" She let go of my wrist and looked away. I thought, maybe she wants to protect Joseph. Maybe she thinks I'm like Isabel. I'm no good for him. "Don't worry," I said, stepping back. "The summer's almost over, anyway." Oh, the look she gave me then. She shut the cash drawer with a demented ding and pushed a long, iron-colored strand of hair back into its knot at the back of her head.
"That's when the trouble starts, sweetheart. Trust me."
5. I walked away down Hemlock Street and around the corner to ascend West Cliff Road back to Greyfriars, devouring my ice cream as it melted in sticky rivulets around my hand. I wanted to experience the mile and a half back to Greyfriars by the pace of my own 2 feet. I wanted to stretch my legs and feel the sunshine on my neck, the crumbled asphalt beneath my soles. I started up the road, under the shade of the huge elms, until the houses grew apart and the sidewalk fell away, and so did the trees. I started up the slope and felt the breeze strike my cheek, blowing in unchecked from the southwest, and somewhere in the middle of that zephyr came the sound of my name, Miranda. I turned and shaded my eyes against the afternoon glare. For a moment I didn't see him, and then he burst free from the sun. His face was shadowed, but I knew that silhouette, those dungarees, and that white shirt almost blue as he jogged to catch me. I held myself absolutely still as he approached. Only my blood moved, hurtling down my arms and legs and up into my hot face. He came to a stop a few yards away, panting. "There you are. Why'd you run off like that?" "I was hot," I said. He stared at me in disbelief while the rhythm of his breathing slowed and slowed. A trickle of perspiration ran down his temple and over the bones of his jaw. "Just like that. Leave without saying anything?"
"Your father..."
"My father what?" I held up the remains of my ice cream. "He told me to have an ice cream and get lost."
"Don't listen to Pops, listen to me."
The wind came up over the nearby cliff and flattened his shirt to his ribs. He wiped his shining temple with his thumb. The heat of exertion rippled from his body and reached mine, and I raised my fingers to hide the pulse in my neck, thudding and thudding like some kind of machine, while the two of us stared at each other, unable to speak, unable to look away. At last, Joseph said hoarsely,
"I'm sorry, Miranda, I apologize. I shouldn't have done what I did."
"All right." I turned back up the road and started walking. He caught up in a few strides.
"That's it," he said. "All right."
"I don't know what to say, that's all."
"Are you mad at me or not? I thought you..." "I'm sorry if I saw it all wrong. I just thought, when you looked at me in the water, I thought you wouldn't mind. You said you didn't mind."
"I didn't. I don't." He took my elbow and turned me to face him.
"Is that true? Just tell me plain, Miranda. Tell me straight out. Did you want me to kiss you or not?"
"Yes," I whispered.
"Since when?"
Since the morning of the wedding? Since you dove into the water and saved Popeye?" His hand dropped from my elbow. He looked up at the sky and started to laugh.
"All this time? You mean all this time?"
"Joseph, please." He looked back into my face.
"For me, it started a few hours later. That night when you stood up in the sand and said once more unto the breach, I just stared at you and thought I could listen to her forever. I really could."
"But Isabel."
"Isabel, Isabel, what about her?"
"Those notes. I saw you meet her at night in secret."
"Oh, boy. Oh, Miranda."
"What?
You're kidding me, right? Isabel?"
"Yes," I said, obstinate. "Isabel."
"Holy moly, you're serious. You actually think..."
He broke off in a laugh.
"Was that it? Was that why you kept giving me the cold shoulder? Oh, Izzy, Izzy, you little devil. Listen to me. Listen up. You can just forget that thought, okay? Forget all about it. Wash it right out of your head. But nothing. I never touched her. I wouldn't touch her. We've known each other since we were kids. I never... Oh, boy. How do I explain this? All right, I know how it looked. I can see what you must have thought if Izzy didn't explain."
"Explain what?" He just gazed at me, real steady, and for a moment there was nothing but the sound of the wind, the sea noises, the air in our lungs.
"You just have to believe me," Joseph said at last. "She's my friend, that's all."
"But all those notes," I said.
"I can tell you didn't read them, did you?"
"Of course I didn't."
"We're friends, Miranda. We're good friends. We talked, that's all. I swear it on my mother's soul, the only girl...
He took a breath like he was going to try again to finish that sentence. But while my ears strained hard for the next words, I never heard them. Only the whoosh of the breeze in my ears. We stood near the crest of the slope, where the road curved near the cliffs, and I thought that anybody could see us like this, in pungent silhouette against the sky. The sun struck the side of Joseph's face, the wind whistled through his hair. He picked up my hand and looked at it, turned it over, and looked back up at me.
"There's only one girl on my mind," Joseph said, "and it's not Isabel Fisher. Trust me. I only just met this girl, but I can't seem to get her out of my head, no matter how hard I try. No matter how many hours I kill out there on that water, and when I saw this girl today, this fascinating girl, kind of shy but full of brains and soul and life, when I saw her down there in the harbor today, when I saw she'd walked all the way down before dawn, just to give me some stupid note from a friend of mine, I thought maybe there was a chance after all.
I pulled my hand away. "Miranda, wait. I'm so stupid," I said. "I should never have done that."
"But you did. You did. And you can't take it back. You can't tell me you didn't want to kiss me, that kissing me wasn't the reason you went out on that boat today, the same reason I invited you."
"Isabel, Isabel, nothing. I already explained. You don't understand," I said. "Maybe she's just a friend to you, but to her, don't you see it? Don't you see what she feels?"
He stared at me. "That's not what she feels."
"It is, trust me. Just because she's engaged to someone else,
this is crazy. Miranda, please, I promise you, you're seeing it all wrong. And hell, you know what? She is engaged to someone else. There's not a single reason on this earth why..."
The sentence trailed away, as if he'd lost the thought behind it. He looked away, frowning out to sea. I thought of Isabel, what she would say if she saw us now, what she would think of me. "She's engaged," I thought. "She has no right to him."
"Unless you didn't mean it back there on the water," he said. "Unless you were just having a few kicks with the lobsterman's son, I get it."
"That's not true."
"Swell."
He glanced down at his left hand, and for the first time I noticed the object contained there, which he now lifted and held out to me. My cardigan of navy blue.
"You left this on the boat."
I stared down at the cardigan, which was damp and crumpled, and I thought, I don't want this. This is not what I want. I want the hand, the large, short-fingered, work-hardened, fish-scented hand, not the damned cardigan. "That's not true," I said again. "It wasn't a few kicks. It was everything. All summer, why do you think I kept delivering those stupid messages? Why do you think, didn't you see it?" His hand dropped back to his side. He was shaking his head.
"What are you saying? What are you saying, Miranda?"
"I wanted to stop. It hurt so much, but I couldn't stop. Just to see you. Not until I promised myself, I promised God, well, something."
Joseph's face was soft with wonder, with disbelief. I drew in breath.
"But Isabel..."
"Forget Isabel," Joseph said. "Just say it to me plain, straight out, so I can understand you."
"What do you want me to say?"
"I want you to tell me you're as crazy about me as I am about you. That's what I want."
"That depends on how crazy you are, I guess."
"I am. I am. At this exact second, Miranda, I am pretty much goddamned certifiable."
"Well, I'm crazier than that, believe me," I said, and Joseph moved forward then, made a whoop of jubilation as he put his arms around my waist and hoisted me up in the air so my hands were on his shoulders and his nose crashed into the hollow of my neck.
"Saturday, the 11th of August," he said. "She loves me. She loves me."
6. That hour on the cliffs, I remember it still. The innocence of it. The clean newness. The way we tumbled to the grass and kissed and laughed and kissed again, seized by a kind of giddy, childlike wonder I have never felt again. Not a single article of clothing came out of place. I mean, maybe my dress rode up a little, but that was all. That was enough. Just to put my arms around his neck, just to lie there in the prickling grass and touch my mouth to Joseph's mouth. Just to know the curve of his shoulder and the angle of his elbow and the weight of his knee was enough. Or maybe it wasn't. In the middle of some delicate, heady maneuver, in which the tip of Joseph's tongue found the tip of mine, and my hips arched upward in reflex, he broke off and rolled onto his back. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"Nothing. Just catching my breath.
I didn't mean to..."
"It's not you, believe me. Give me a minute, that's all."
I rolled on my side and stared across the plain of his shirt to the long grass beyond, and it seemed I could see every blade, every seed and speck and insect. I perceived every detail of the world around me. How many ages ago lived the fog that had existed that morning, in the vague before of my life? Now I lived in the after. Oh, brave new world that has such people in it. And my lungs breathed with Joseph's breath, and my limbs warmed with Joseph's warmth. "It's real, isn't it?" I said. "We're not dreaming this."
"I don't know. Feels like a dream to me. I mean, I've been dreaming it all summer. So what are the odds you're really there?"
"Well, what are the odds we're both having the same dream?"
"For God's sake, I'm just a fellow hauling lobsters out of Long Island Sound. You're Miranda Schuyler. You're a Foxcroft girl, Hugh Fisher's stepdaughter. You're like one of the stars in the sky."
"No, I'm not. I'm anything but that."
"It's true. You hang there twinkling at me, and I can't even reach you."
"All right, then you're the earth. You're everything solid and real and strong." Joseph laughed.
"Jesus, Mary, listen to us like a couple of fools, stars and earth. How about we're just a boy and a girl, lying around an island somewhere, and the boy wants to kiss the girl again, but he's afraid. If he turns around, she won't be there after all."
I reached for his opposite shoulder and pulled him on his side to face me. "You see? Here I am."
"There you are."
"From now on, whenever you turn around, I'll be here."
"Until the end of summer, anyway. A few weeks, not even that."
"Is that all?"
"I don't know about you, but I'm due in Providence for convocation on the 4th of September."
There was a tuft of grass in his hair. I lifted my hand and picked it away. "I want it back. All that time we had, I wish we could just call all those weeks back and live them again."
"It wouldn't have gone any differently. Just be glad for what we've got."
"You'll be fishing all morning."
"You could come with me. And we have the afternoons, evenings, at least until the happy couple returns from Europe."
He took my hand and drew it away from his hair, climbed to his feet, pulling me with him.
"Come on, I'll walk you home and make you a sandwich."
"I can make sandwiches."
"Not as good as mine, I'll bet."
He plucked the grass out of my hair and my dress and helped me with my cardigan. And we walked along the deserted road hand in hand while the sun dropped behind us. As the road curved back away from the cliffs, the Greyfriars Drive appeared, lined by rhododendrons, the distant house, the meadow bordered by a low stone wall, painstakingly maintained to a state of picturesque dilapidation. We hadn't said a word since rising, and we didn't speak now as we turned down the gravel lane. On each side of the driveway, the rhododendrons had grown in thick with stiff, waxy new leaves, obscuring the meadow and the sea cliffs, the facade of Greyfriars itself. I felt as if a great weight had descended on my chest, constricting my breath. Joseph kicked the gravel and made a noise of frustration, like he, too, was trying to lift something heavy and couldn't quite get his weight under it. There was a particular enormous rhododendron, ancient, right on the corner, that might have shielded a small car if someone had been so bold as to drive inside the shelter of its branches. I reached out as we passed and ripped away a single leaf, an act of terrible desecration. I don't know why. I crushed it in my fingers and dropped it to the ground just before we rounded the bend, and Greyfriars slid into view like an ocean liner. Ahead of us, the house sat primly, shingled in gray cedar and trimmed in white, windows sparkling, looking so much statelier than it did from the other side. The front of the place was formal, tidy, symmetrical as could be, but from this decorous facade, Greyfriars rambled every which way, trying to catch the sunshine and the sea views from every possible angle, and I never could quite get over the difference between the two sides, front and back. Either way you looked, it was beautiful. You couldn't deny its beauty and its size, its class and its pedigree. No more like my old, damp cottage at Foxcroft than a child's clay sculpture compared to the Winged Victory. "It's your home now," Isabel had told me once as we skidded around this exact curve one night, returning from some party at the club. She was sentimental with cocktails and cigarettes, and when we came to a stop just outside the garage, spilling happily onto the grass, she leaned down and laid her head on my lap and gazed up at the stars. She looked so tender and happy. I hadn't wanted to bruise her with the knowledge that this wasn't my home, didn't feel like my home, was instead like some elegant private hotel in which I had taken up residence for the summer. And Isabel herself was like some friend you meet in a hotel like that, also staying for the summer, with whom you strike up a passionate friendship, all the more fierce for its unlikelihood, its mismatch, because you know that it's not going to last. You're going to leave at the beginning of September in a flurry of promises to write and meet up over Christmas, and though you may both believe this at the time, you also know it's simply not going to happen. You're not really friends. You're not really sisters. You're just pretending. No, it's more than that. You're not pretending. You're acting in a play, in a film, and for that space of time, it's perfectly real. And there's your trouble, right there. I turned to Joseph just as he turned to me, and the suddenness of his earnest face almost made me forget what I meant to say to him. "Isabel," I gasped.
"What about her?"
"What are we going to tell her?"
"I guess we'll just tell her the truth."
"She'll hate me for it."
Joseph shook his head. "You're wrong about that, Miranda, you'll see. I'm telling you, you worried about the wrong Fisher."
"You mean my stepfather? Why should he care?"
"He'll care plenty, believe me."
"It's none of his business. He's not my father, is he?"
"Miranda," said Joseph,
and I looked away toward the garage. He touched my temple with his thumb, smoothing the skin, and went on.
"I'll just have to bite the bullet, I guess. Walk up to him, hat in hand, like every other fellow who's fallen in love with a girl he shouldn't, and explain myself."
"You don't need to do that. It's not the Middle Ages."
"What else am I going to do? I'm not going to sneak around with you. And if he sees me hanging about, he's going to want to know why."
"Well, they won't be back from Europe until Labor Day. Isabel, on the other hand..."
"Never mind Isabel. Right now there's nobody to worry about. Not a thing to think about except you and me."
He tugged my hand.
"Let's enjoy it, all right? Every last minute, starting now. Come on, we'll pack some sandwiches and I'll take you sailing. There's this beach I know where nobody goes. Build a nice fire and stay out all night with the stars. How does that sound?"
"Like heaven." So we ran down the lawn toward the kitchen door, but before we reached it, Joseph just stopped and let go of my hand, stood there arrested on the grass, staring toward the water. "What's the matter?" I said, but I really didn't need to ask. I just followed his gaze down the slope of the lawn to the dock, where a long, elegant yacht lay against the side, taking up all the space there was. The Fisher King. 7. There was something different about my mother after her honeymoon, though I couldn't quite put my finger on the change at first. She looked as beautiful as ever, maybe more beautiful, but it wasn't that. I remember how she came out on the terrace and called my name, just as I turned in shock from the sight of the yacht to absorb the meaning of Joseph's stark face.
"Mama,"
I whispered, and then, turning in the direction of her voice,
"Mama!"
I ran across the lawn and up the stone steps to the terrace. We met right in the middle, hugging and laughing, and yet there was some slight reserve, some bit of Mama held back from me. I pulled back and she pulled back, and I thought she looked older. Not in weeks and days, the clock hours passed since we saw each other last, but in experience. There was something worldly and mysterious in the shape of her eyes and the width of her smile, like she had finally grown up. Before I could say anything, another voice called my name, I turned to open French doors just as Hugh Fisher stepped across the threshold in a suit of impeccable summer wool. His pale hair instantly caught the flash of the setting sun. He smiled and held out his arms to me.
"My new daughter,"
he said, and of course I went to him and embraced him too. Expressed my surprise, my delight at their early return. Hugh looked at my mother and she looked at him, and a thought passed between them.
"We just couldn't stay away any longer," Hugh said, and his head turned toward the lawn,
where Joseph still stood with his hands folded behind his back.
"Joseph, nice to see you."
There was some faint question at the end of the sentence, a bit of upturn. I said quickly, "Isabel's off on the mainland, so I went out fishing with the Vargases today."
"Oh, what fun," said my mother.
"That's good of you," said Hugh to Joseph. "I'm sure our girl was in good hands."
"The best," I said. "We caught 42 lobsters."
"My goodness, whatever did you do with them?" asked my mother.
"We sold them in the market, of course. That's how they make a living."
"Oh, of course, how silly of me. Would you like to stay for dinner?" she said to Joseph.
"That's kind of you, Mrs. Fisher, but I'd better be going home now."
I stepped forward.
"Oh, wait!"
My stepfather put his hand on my shoulder, and his grip surprised me with its strength.
"Joseph's gotta be up early, sweetheart. Maybe another time."
"Yes,"
Joseph said, "maybe another time."
I started to say something, but Mr. Fisher's hand tightened on my shoulder, and Joseph gave me a quick, hard stare that wanted to tell me something, only not just yet. "I had a wonderful time today, Joseph," I said instead. "Thank you."
"Any time."
He made a small salute and turned to go.
"Give my regards to your parents," said Mr. Fisher.
8. Here's a funny thing. In all our weeks here on the island, from the wedding at the beginning of June until now, the 11th of August, we hadn't eaten any meals in that grand, beautiful dining room overlooking the cliffs. We'd taken every single dinner at the club or at somebody's house, and so I hesitated when we entered it, Mr. Fisher and my mother and I, wondering where to sit, and also, in a larger sense, where on earth I was. Where did it come from, this acre of white tablecloth, this crystal and silver, these beautiful plates of delicate, paper-thin porcelain edged in gold? And Esther in her best crisp uniform, like it was 100 years ago. Mr. Fisher didn't hesitate. He was accustomed to such things, I guess. He pulled out Mama's chair and then mine, which turned out to be right in the center of the table between the two of them, but not within reach of either. And Mama sat like a princess, all dignity and decorum, selecting the proper fork and directing Esther with small, discreet, elegant gestures. A perfume wafted occasionally from her skin, when Esther's movements created the right direction of draft, and I didn't recognize the scent.
"I've sent out the yacht to fetch Isabel," Hugh said. "She'll be home first thing tomorrow, I hope."
"Wonderful," said Mama. "I can't wait to see her again. I expect you've had a wonderful time getting to know each other, haven't you?"
"Wonderful," I said.
"You did say Providence, didn't you?" said Hugh.
"Yes, the Biltmore, they told me. I have the telephone number."
Mama said, "But why didn't you go to Providence, sweet pea? Don't you want to buy some new things? I'm sure Hugh wouldn't mind if you bought a few things, would you, darling?"
"Buy all you want," said my stepfather.
"You'll need new clothes for college, after all," said Mama.
"You should have gone. Why didn't you go?"
Esther came around with a large dish, from which Mama served herself. I watched the deft motions of her hands and said, "I wanted to stay here, that's all." Hugh, who was gazing intently at my face, turned to the window.
"So I see."
We ate. I don't remember what. I had a small view of the water from my seat, and I kept glancing that way in hopes of something. Some sign of Joseph, I guess. Some sign that I hadn't dreamt what happened that afternoon, that I was still living in the brave new after of my life. I'd changed into a dinner dress, and my bare arms were so lean and sunburned that Mama remarked about it.
You're looking awfully tanned yourself, Mama, I said. I guess Europe agrees with you. She gazed across the table at her husband, and it's a look I haven't forgotten, because I'd never before seen that expression on her face, and I never did again. Hugh agrees with me, she said gently, and I remember thinking that she could have said marriage. Marriage agrees with me. But she said his name instead, because she meant one specific husband, her new husband, Hugh. He set down his fork and looked back at my mother the way you might look at the sun, newly risen.
Darling, shall we tell her?
I thought we were going to wait until after dinner.
I can't wait any longer. I feel as if I've been waiting my life for this. I'm about to burst with joy.
Oh, Hugh. I reached for my wine and swallowed it. My fingers went a little numb. Waiting for what? I said. Dearest, my mother said, turning to me, stretching her long arm toward my hand, and I saw it then in the glow of her face, the new fullness in her cheeks, so she didn't need to go on. But of course she did. Dearest Miranda, it's the most wonderful news. You're going to be a sister. We're going to be a real family at last.
9. I waited until just before 11 o'clock, when the light in the master bedroom winked out. I had discovered, you see, that I could see the corner of their room from mine. Such was the rambling construction of the Greyfriars' rear facade. And because sometimes people turn out the light and then realize they've forgotten something, a book or a glass of water or whatever it is, and they rise again with a muttered oath, I waited a few more minutes, just to be sure. I listened for any voices, for any telltale vibrations, although, of course, they were really too far away from me, all the way at the other end of the house. Still, I waited until the silence reached such a pitch as to satisfy me. Then I threw back my comforter and stole out the door and down the back stairs to the kitchen, the same way I had gone that first morning when I ran down to meet Joseph and Popeye on the dock. Throughout the summer, Isabel had bemused me by her refusal to use the telephone to communicate with Joseph. Why bother with all that cloak and dagger business, with sending messages and flashing lights and such nonsense, when you could just pick up a telephone receiver and speak directly? Now I knew. I considered the possibility of being overheard, of Mama or Hugh or the housemaid picking up the extension, of Mrs. Vargas or Mr. Vargas answering the telephone in the lighthouse instead of Joseph. Impossible even to think of it. Instead, I ran directly down to the boathouse and found the flashlight and made for the dock. But as I passed by the handsome Lutyens bench at the edge of the seawall, I heard my name in a voice that seemed a little amused. Joseph! I turned, but I couldn't see him, because the clouds had moved in around sunset, and the moon was obscured. I just saw a movement in the darkness, a shadow pass between me and the lights of Greyfriars, and then a hand touched mine. I flung my arms around his neck. Ouch, he said. Sorry, that's the flashlight.
Flashlight?
I was going to signal you.
But you don't know the code, do you?
I thought you'd figure it out anyway.
He laughed. I wasn't going to wait around for any damned flashlight, believe me.
I drew back. How long have you been waiting?
Not long. A half hour, maybe. I figured if you were going to steal away, you'd have to wait until your parents went to bed.
If I was going to steal away? I said.
He shrugged. I couldn't be sure.
We stood apart by only a few inches. My right hand gripped the flashlight. My other hand had somehow found his. The connection seemed both tenuous and momentous, as if the firm, intimate touch of his fingers was too good to last. Let's go to this beach of yours, I said.
We can't. You can't stay out all night, not with your parents home. Anyway, I don't have any sandwiches, and it's too dark to sail that far.
Then let's go to the lighthouse. We can sit on the rocks, on that little beach there, like the first night.
Why not stay here? Nobody's going to find us.
No, I want to go somewhere. I want to get away from Greyfriars. He glanced over my shoulder,
almost as if he could detect the sea behind me.
Tide's pretty high right now. With the full moon, the current's going to murder someone.
Please, Joseph, not here, anywhere but here. There must have been some note of desperation in my voice, because he didn't say anything for a moment, and I could just about hear the sound of his thoughts turning over, or maybe it was the sound of the blood in his veins, the blood in my veins, our heartbeats, our breath, our longing. He cupped a hand around my cheek, and the heat of his palm surprised me.
I'll take you wherever you want to go, he said. Remember that.
10. For many years afterward, I thought about that journey across the Fleet Rock Channel, and whether I felt some kind of portent as Joseph positioned the boat inside the mighty rush of the tide. But no. At that moment, I felt nothing but exhilaration, nothing but the lightness of escape and of coming joy. I remember the breeze was chillier than I expected, as if something new and cool had insinuated itself into the atmosphere since the afternoon. But I imagined it meant only that autumn was coming, that we had better snatch our delights while we could. Anyway, Joseph had given me his thick, cabled sweater, had settled it over my head with his own hands, so the chill couldn't find me. I certainly didn't notice that Joseph struggled over much with the oars. The journey toward the lighthouse was easier when the tide was rushing out, as it then did, because Fleet Rock lay a little to the east of Greyfriars, not true south. Going back was the trouble. We'd have to wait until the tide slackened. Not even Joseph could haul us into the Greyfriars dock against a full spring tide. But I wasn't thinking about our return journey at all. I think, at the time, I wanted to stay on that rock forever with Joseph. You know how it is when you're 18 and you've fallen in love for the first time? I watched him leap to the dock with the rope and secure the boat. I moved to the bow and took his hand and leaped too. He made one of his joyful noises and kissed me, and we scrambled without words over the rocks to the small, coarse beach on the other side, nearly engulfed by the tide, where he found us a tiny resting place, like a nest, and the water washed up almost to our toes. I tucked my head in the hollow of his shoulder and spoke softly. The moon shines bright in such a night as this, when the sweet wind did gently kiss the trees and they did make no noise. In such a night, Troilus, methinks, mounted the Trojan walls and sighed his soul toward the Grecian tents where Cressid lay that night. He laughed and answered me.
In such a night did Thisbe fearfully o'ertip the dew and saw the lion's shadow ere himself and ran dismayed away.
Why, how did you know that?
Maybe you're not the only one who knows a little Shakespeare, Miss Schuyler. They teach this stuff in the Winthrop Island School, too.
But they don't make you memorize it, do they?
I guess I always liked that bit. What comes next?
Dido, I said. In such a night stood Dido with a willow in her hand, upon the wild sea banks, and waft her love to come again to Carthage.
Poor Dido, said Joseph. He never did come back, did he?
No, he never did. The water kicked against the rocks. How strange to be nestled here in Joseph's arms, the two of us alone in the universe, talking about Dido. Across the water, the lights of Long Island twinkled, as if from the other side of the ocean, the other side of the world.
I used to sit on this beach and dream about sailing away somewhere, Joseph said.
Where?
Anywhere, everywhere, see the world.
You'd need to build a bigger sailboat, I said, and find a crew.
That's what I used to think.
So you gave it up?
Sort of. I don't know. Lately I've been dreaming of something else. Like I might find some girl to sail with me.
He held me in front of him, between his legs, inside the arc of his arms. His chin rested on the top of my head.
Just sail away together, without telling anyone. Maybe go to Bermuda first, just to get our sea legs, and then head south, the Caribbean, South America. If we liked some place well enough, we'd stop and build a hut on the beach and live there. What's the matter?
It sounds beautiful, that's all.
Course, I'd have to finish college first, work hard for a year or two, saving up to build a good, strong, sweet sailing ship.
Yes, I said, and a drop of rain fell on my nose.
Wouldn't be for years yet, I guess, but it would be worth it. Just think.
I turned in his arms. Why not now? Just leave. Just elope. Borrow somebody's sailboat if you have to.
Because she might have second thoughts. Somewhere off the coast of Brazil or maybe Argentina, when the weather starts to turn.
Never.
Well, he said, kissing the top of my head, I guess we'll have to just wait and see. You might have other ideas after your first year of college.
I might have a lot of new ideas, but this one won't change.
Miranda.
He pressed his palm against the back of my head, urging me into the softness of his sweater. I breathed in the scent of wool and wondered why he stopped me. When I had so much I wanted to say, so many words cramming the inside of me.
Joseph said, Listen to me. I want you to promise me something. Just one thing.
What's that?
When you get to college.
Don't talk about that yet.
No, I mean it. When you get to college, I want you to think about auditioning for something. The school play, whatever it is.
What?
I'm serious. You're a natural. There's something inside you, and when it comes out, I can't explain. I just think you ought to try. Promise me.
Maybe.
Don't maybe. Do it. Look, I'll tell you what. You try out for that play, whatever it is, and I'll come to watch you. I'll borrow some fellow's car. I'll bring 5 dozen roses. We'll go out to dinner someplace grand.
Oh, stop.
I mean it. I do.
I don't want to act in front of a bunch of people.
With you, it's not acting. It's something else. It's you, coming alive with something I can't even... And I don't want to be the fellow who stands in your way.
But I don't want to share that with anyone but you.
Miranda, just promise me.
I didn't answer. At Foxcroft, I had never considered performing in anything. The terror of standing on a stage, of not being good enough, had held me fast. Now Joseph's arms held me fast. The world spread out before me, vast and twinkling with promise. He laid his hands on my hands and spoke in my ear.
There's something I need to tell you.
11. Something I need to tell you. Those were the words I heard when my uncle came to tell me about Daddy. He worked in the War Office. That's how he knew the news first. Instead of sending a telegram, they sent Uncle Harry. He wore his best uniform, so I knew something was wrong, even before I looked at his face. My mother was already upstairs, crying. He crouched down, so that he was right down at my level, eye to eye. He was a handsome man, my Uncle Harry. Blue Schuyler eyes, fair Schuyler hair. In my hair, I take after my mother.
There's something I have to tell you, Miranda, he said, taking my hand. It's about your father.
And I don't remember his exact words. I just remember that the walls and the floor disappeared, and I was falling irretrievably into darkness, and the only thing holding me steady was my Uncle Harry's strong arms, which were scratchy and smelled of wet wool. A week later, Uncle Harry left for Italy and never came back. 12. So you'll forgive me if I shivered a little when Joseph said those words to me. There's something I need to tell you. Shivered and pulled away, actually launched myself out of his arms, so that he had to take my hand and ask me what was wrong. You tell me, I said.
You can't tell anybody else. You have to promise me that. Not even my father. Especially not my father.
Why? What's it about?
Sort of a family secret. I've been thinking about telling you all evening, since I left you at Greyfriars. Not because I want to cause trouble or anything, but because I want to be straight with you. I don't want to hide anything. And Isabel, you had the wrong idea. I wanted to explain so you'd understand. You'd know there's no possibility. Isabel...
Isabel what?
She's my sister.
For a moment, I just knelt there on the damp sand. A gust of wind blew against us, the vanguard of some approaching squall. I remember counting the sweeps of the light above us, though I don't remember how many passed.
You're what?
I whispered.
You see, a long time ago, before I was born, obviously.
So your father...
is Hugh Fisher, he said. Is your stepfather.
He's your father?
Yes.
I noticed, in some distant part of my brain, that the wind continued to rise, that the few tiny drops had turned into a drizzle. It struck my head, it struck Joseph's forehead and his nose. I reached up and wiped the rain from his cheek, but it was no use. As soon as my hand moved away, there was more rain behind it. Hugh Fisher, I thought. Hugh Fisher is his father, fathered him. Engaged with some woman, with Joseph's mother. And made Joseph, and made, at almost the same time, but not quite the same time, Isabel. My stepfather did this. Hugh Fisher did this.
Say something, he said.
Say what?
You look like you don't believe me.
I do, I don't know what to think. How... your mother...
They had an affair, just before he married Isabel's mother. He didn't realize she was pregnant until it was too late. So they made the best of things. She married Dad, and that's why she and the aunts don't get along, because my Aunt Francisca was supposed to marry him instead. And then, when I was born, Francisca took a boat out to Fleet Rock, nobody knows why, and you know she drowned. So it's trouble all around, and...
How did you find out?
Mama told me, when I was about 10 or 11. She was worried because I spent so much time playing with Isabel, because we were so close even then. She wanted to make sure I knew so that, well, you know.
Does Isabel know?
She knows.
So all that time...
All that time.
Oh, my God, I said. Oh, my God. Another gust swept against us, a handful of nervous raindrops, and now I felt it. At last, I felt a premonition prickling my skin. Or maybe it was just that first wave of rain, needle-sharp, promising a deluge in due course. I knelt there in the sand and stared at Joseph's anxious face, trying to comprehend the facts, the meaning of the facts, the meaning of the meaning. A whole world, a vast history of Winthrop Island I had never in my innocence suspected. Isabel and Joseph, brother and sister. Mr. Fisher and Mrs. Vargas. What?
Don't be afraid, Joseph said. It's just me. Same fellow I was a minute ago.
I shook my head and tried to speak. Joseph started to reach for me, but his hands fell back at the last instant. His eyes were glassy with fear and moonlight.
I'm sorry. He said, I'm sorry.
I thought, I must do something. I have to do something before the squall arrives. I took his face in my hands, and exactly as my fingers touched his cheeks, the rain began to descend in earnest, heavy drops, so I kissed him. I thought if I kissed him, the rain would stop, the coming squall would dissolve harmlessly into the air, and Joseph, I don't know what he thought, just that he kissed me back as frantically as I kissed him. That his warm hands laid themselves upon my skin, under his sweater he had given me, under my pajama shirt beneath that, and it seemed to me that something of myself flowed like a current from my body into his, that something of him returned into me by the same channel. I couldn't feel the rain anymore. I pulled him down on the beach with me, and there was this moment in which the tide might have turned, the course of our history might have diverted into another strait. Joseph's hands found my breasts, my legs slid around his, and I remember thinking I would do anything, I would give anything I had to keep him there, hold him there, until the storm passed at last. I would arch my hips against his, I would slip my hands to the waist of his trousers and... Joseph flung himself away, panting, and said in a hoarse voice, "You're getting soaked. Let's go inside." "I don't care, I don't care." We stared at each other, a couple of inches apart. The rain rattled the stones around us and coursed through my hair and my face and neck, so I felt I was drowning. Above our heads, the light made a long, eternal sweep.
"Promise me something," he said.
Don't ever let them keep you down. Those bastards, don't let them change you.
What bastards?
He stood up. Let's go inside.
13.